It's January 24th, 2003. I'm Fred Hanhart, and I'm interviewing Dick Burnett. And Dick, you can see that we are taping this. Do we have your permission to do so?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. Dick, could you start by giving some background as to where you're born and raised?
I was born December 16th, 1921 in Monroe, Michigan, in the house that my mother lived in for 75 years. I think it's interesting in itself that my mother only had three residences during her now still existing life. She was born on a farm in Monroe County, lived there until she got married, moved into the house where I was born in 1920. I had to move her out in 1995 into a nursing home, and she's still there. She'll be 102 February the 5th of this year.
My gosh, that's quite a record. So you go to school in Monroe?
I'm a graduate of a parochial grade school and Monroe High School.
And then did you go on to college or?
I came to Michigan State College in 1939, degree in police administration, that it was called then. Uncle Sam gave me a job for 4 years. I came out, went to work for the city of Monroe for about 2.5 years, and then Michigan State called me and asked me to come up here for an interview for a job that they were offering.
Go back just a little bit. When you graduated from Michigan State, you then went into the service.
That's right.
And what did you do in the service when you were there?
I initially was assigned to an OCS program, even though I had 4 years of ROTC, because we did not have the six-week summer camp, which was then a requirement for commissioning. I and all of my classmates in police ed were assigned to various OCS programs, and I went to the military police program at Fort Custer. Upon completion of that, I did two things. I became an officer and a gentleman on a Friday, and on Sunday I became a married man, and I was reassigned back to the Provost-Marshal General School as an instructor in the traffic program of the school, and then ultimately was assigned as a company officer to the 701st MP Battalion, and then to an island in Narragansett Bay to work with German PWs to teach them to become police officers back in Germany.
Now, was this after the war at that point?
Yes. The war had concluded while I was at a port of embarkation to make the assault on Japan. So anyone who talks about the non-use of the atomic bomb has an argument with me.
Understandable.
Anyhow, I concluded my non-illustrious military career at Fort Myer, Virginia, and was discharged from the Pentagon.
And then you went back to Monroe,
I went back to Monroe. Used up the 90 days of free money that was given to veterans, and which incidentally was created by an increase in the cigarette tax. And when I figured that I'd used up my free money from the cigarette tax, I quit smoking cigarettes.
That was a good decision.
So I worked in the city of Monroe for about 2.5 years when I got a telephone call from Art Brandstetter out of a clear blue sky.
What were you doing in Monroe?
I worked for the city of Monroe as a fireman. And I came to Michigan State as the first safety officer, not police officer, mm-hmm. but safety officer that the university employed. And my specialty was fire prevention. That continued in that capacity when Brandstetter, with some assistance from me, established the current Department of Public Safety concept, which integrated safety and law enforcement into one organization.
What was the campus like at that time?
When I was a student or after that?
Both.
Well, as a student, the enrollment was around 6,500, as I recall. All of the academic buildings, except one, were north of the river. The only one south of the river at that time, when I came, was Demonstration Hall, where military was taught. And while I was there, Jennison Fieldhouse was built.
Mm-hmm.
And I witnessed the first basketball game played there between Michigan State and Tennessee, which Michigan State won.
That's a nice way to start.
Yeah. The only other building south of the river that was quasi-non-agriculture was the Livestock Pavilion. And I say quasi because that's where we practice baseball in the wintertime. I came to Michigan State hoping someday to be a professional baseball player. Uncle Sam gave me a job in lieu of that. And
that who was the coach then?
John Cobes.
What was he like as a coach?
As a player, he was totally different than as a person after your eligibility was used up. He was gruff, hard to please as a player, but once you used up your eligibility and came back like I did, he became one of the good old boys. So it was quite a transformation in his personality. But I don't think that was a change in his part. It's just the way he was.
Mm-hmm. What position did you play?
I call it a pitcher, but more accurately, a thrower. there's a difference.
Yes, there is. There is. Having played that position as well.
I started out as a shortstop and broke my leg in high school. And that what speed I had, which wasn't of any great consequence, disappeared. And then because I had a strong throwing arm, I tried the pitching angle and made it as in a collegiate atmosphere and some semi-pro after that.
And what was the transformation like when you came back after being away for 6 years?
Well, I'm going to insert Ralph Turner into this response. I had been gone during that period of time from 1943 to 1950, and I thought I knew the campus quite well. In the interim, that 6 years, the campus began to grow. And I had not met Ralph Turner until the day I reported for work, April 1, 1950. And the reason I met Ralph was because Brandstetter at that point, who was my boss, was in Germany working for the federal government. And Ralph was interim director of the department. And Ralph gave me one of the nicest opportunities to get my feet on the ground by saying, take a week and just walk around and find out where you're at. And it was worth it because the campus growth had been already begun and accelerated beyond my memory of 1943. So it was an interesting week just to get my feet on the ground geographically.
Where did you stay when you came?
When the job was offered to me, sometime in, say, March, I came up to East Lansing and got an apartment in the barracks. And I think the right address was 303A Hickory Lane.
Mm-hmm.
It was the street nearest the railroad tracks.
Right.
And at that moment in time, our only child was on the way. And he was born on the 5th of May, and I came starting the 1st of April. So I had about a 30-day period here where I was alone living in that barracks apartment at 303A Hickory Lane. That's where I stayed, and we stayed there for, if I recall, approximately a year. and then bought a house on South Hagedorn Road.
And what were your duties when you first started out, you had your week?
I was the university's first safety officer, and sort of a jack of all trades, but fire prevention was the reason for my being here. Michigan State University at that prior to that moment was relying totally upon the services of East Lansing Fire Department. And the insurance industry, I am told the university, you're not getting your money's worth, you better get somebody in here to take care of your own problems. As being a part-time fire prevention person from the city of East Lansing. So I came in a full-time capacity to that end. And it was a very delightful job because I was my own boss, basically. I was part of the campus police organization as it existed then, but I was not a sworn police officer.
Mm-hmm. And so how long did you do that?
I came the 1st of April in 1950, and sometime in 1956, the Department of Public Safety concept came into being, and I was named by Brandstatter to be the assistant director in charge of the police operation, not the safety operation, mm-hmm. The police operation. And then July 1 of 1960, Brandstatter was relieved of one of his several jobs, and I was made the director of the department. And I held that position for 27 years until I retired.
Now, you said you helped Art develop the concept of the police force. Can you elaborate on that some?
Well, among my tours that I had as a safety officer included trips to the Upper Peninsula, because the university has property there and also in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula. And I think Art Brandstatter, and I can understand why, used my trips as an opportunity to get away from it all, if you will. And he joined me, and we batted ideas back and forth in the front seat of the car as one or the other of us was driving along. And we both were of the opinion that the two responsibilities were complementary. And there was little or no sense to have separate organizations with separate administrations. Put them both into one ballpark and let the individuals be eyes for each other in their various capacities, because the safety people had to be in and out of buildings on the campus and could relay what they found to the police department and vice versa. And the concept was, I think, and I say this with not total knowledge, but I sincerely believe that the concept on the Michigan State University campus was the first one in the United States, collegiate-wise. And it's been copied multiple times in other areas.
Who did you have to convince in the administration to support this?
Well, we were fortunate. I say we, I'm speaking of the department, of the campus police organization. Mm-hmm. Art Brandstatter wore two hats, basically. One of those hats he reported directly to John Hanna. So when you say who did you have to convince, it was John Hanna. There was opposition, but those oppositions were swept aside, and the organization came into being.
Where did the opposition come from?
Well, as I recall, one of the opposers was the personnel department, who I don't think really had a role to play, but they did object to it. And as I say, it was swept aside, so.
How was John Hanna to work with, since you spent a fair amount of time when he was in charge?
Well, I worked for all of the presidents from Hanna, and I'm speaking, they were my direct bosses, from Hanath to I'm trying to recall. I think DiBiagio was the last in line that I'm thinking about. And all of them were, in their individual ways, had pluses, and there were certain things that I would say a minus, but that's a personal way. How was John Hammond work for him? He was a very easy person to work for because he gave me one set of instructions. Keep me informed. And I had no bother calling him at 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning and saying, this is what's going on. This is what's happened. Because he did not want to read it in the newspaper. He never interfered with my decisions on who to hire, who to fire, or who to promote. And that gave me a latitude that a lot of people in the position that I occupied don't have, either in municipal government, county government, or on college campuses.
Absolutely.
And not only that, I didn't have to report to the president through a string of sub-governmental heads. And while I was a director, I had an occasion innumerable times to share my ignorance with other universities who employed me as a consultant, unpaid, to look at their operation and give them advice and counsel. And of course, if you don't pay for the advice and counsel, it isn't worth much, but that's neither here nor there. Anyhow,
been there.
I saw some of the most ridiculous chains of command that you can imagine. And so on. And it was, to me, it was an easy way to say to them, get your feet out of your back end, let's get going here. So in the process, a number of fellows that had worked for us actually got jobs doing what I was doing at another institution.
Hmm. Well, that must have been a good feeling.
Well, in the 27 years, and I have never actually counted to be specific, but in the 27 years, employees that I hired, about 40 of them became chief of police. And I don't know of any organization as small as the one on MSU campus that had that kind of impact across the country.
That's a pretty big impact.
I'm talking about chiefs of police, directors of public safety, heads of law enforcement agencies. So we did real well.
That's.
But I guess a philosophy that I had with regard to employing people was that hire people smarter than yourself because they'll make your job easier. Unfortunately, they come and go.
Yeah, they do,
and,
don't they?
And so I've always said the good ones left and I stayed.
Yeah. One of the really difficult times was during the Vietnam War and the campus unrest. And would you talk a little bit about that and from your perspective?
Well, we've already spoken of the fact that I was a soldier in World War II, and I often said during the days of rage, as I called them, it was easier for me as a soldier than it was to being the director of public safety because you knew who your enemy was.
Yeah.
I think the dichotomy of the student body and what one could observe if you were neutral and looked around the campus actually said wonders about the college student body. You'd have 100 people raising hob over in point A, and in point B there'd be 1,500 people playing softball. The two groups had nothing to do with each other. Often the small group that was raising the Dickens had outside people as their spokesmen, their leaders. We had Ayers here, the guy who started SDS, any number of those legendary characters passed through here trying to excite their followers. It was, I have a pretty good head of gray hair right now, and I think some of it came from that. But there were days that you didn't get much sleep, and there were other days it was perfectly normal. And as I say, if you were objective and looked across the campus and saw what was going on, those who were causing problems, as far as we were concerned, were so few in number and yet so nasty to deal with that they overwhelmed, you know, the kids who could care less. I think, well, one of the things that happened, we had a financial recession about 71, 72. And the days of rage stopped. And my philosophy was, or my answer to that was, all of a sudden, Mama and Daddy's checks weren't coming anymore. And those who were here who wanted to go to school had to start doing something other than just playing on the streets. And it was like you draw a curtain. It went from activity to nothing. And it was timed with that recession.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an interesting telephone call one time from an individual, and you may remember on university campuses the so-called panty raid era.
Mm-hmm. Sure do.
Well, anyhow, I came onto the scene at Michigan State College in 1950 when panty raids were the rage. And during the days of rage, the late 60s, early 70s, telephone rang one day, and it was a counterpart of mine at some school that I don't remember, asking, what do you do with panty raids? And here we were dealing with with rock throwers and all kinds of disturbances over a situation that we could do nothing about. You know, the university wasn't involved in the Vietnam War decisions that was done by our politicians. The racial unrest wasn't created at Michigan State College. It was created over the United States as a whole. So here we were, a battleground at times, over issues that couldn't be solved on the campus. It sort of left you feeling hopeless or helpless or something.
Any of the students during that time period that you remember that come particularly to mind?
Yeah, a couple of them who will be nameless.
Okay. What about, it was obviously...
I think one of them you know.
We'll talk about that one later. What about the differences between when, at the end, when President Hanover was having a difficult time with this, and then he left and Walter Adams took over? How did that transition affect you?
Well, Hanna was not a hands-on person with regard to these situations. Adams was. He was basically in the center of all these activities. And one of the fun things that I remember with regard to Walter Adams, as you know, he was a cigar smoker.
Yes.
And we were on the steps of the Student Services Building listening to a harangue from a very foul-mouthed young lady. And she was doing a great job. And she stopped to catch her breath, and Adams flicked his cigar, flicked the ashes off of it, and said, "Miss So-and-so," and he knew her by name, "you're in good voice today." And as a result of that, that entire group that was back of her started laughing. She was no longer the spokesman, she was the butt of the joke. And that's the way Adams, that was a moment in his tenure as the president. I think he became so involved in that sort of thing that it's a good thing that his tenure only lasted about 6 to 9 months. Because I think he'd have killed himself if it had been as long as Hanna had to do it.
Oh.
Because he was extending himself physically. You know, I had the ability to have X number of people that could take over when I went home and got 6 hours sleep or 4 hours sleep, whatever it was. He was there almost constantly.
And then Clifton Wharton replaced him.
And walked in the night when everything broke loose on Grand River.
What a greeting.
Yeah.
How was he to work with?
One of the nicest human beings I've ever known. Mrs. Wharton, the same way. You couldn't ask for a nicer person to work for than Clifton Wharton. And I felt sorry for him often. Because some of his fellow blacks were very nasty toward him, like calling him an Oreo and things like that. And I can remember one night at a basketball game when the basketball team revolted, led by Terry Furlow et al.
Yep.
And Mrs. Wharton and Mr. Wharton I was next to them, and this anti-Wharton cry erupted from the crowd, and Mrs. Wharton very calmly said, "Leave him alone, don't pay any attention to him." She was a very strong lady.
Yes.
Very strong lady. She knew what she wanted, she knew how to do it, and I give her great credit. I had the pleasure of being in their homes, knowing their families. So it was an outstanding opportunity to just know them as people. And I was fortunate for that. It wasn't like the big boss is over there and I'm here and I'll write him a letter.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's quite a level of access that mm-hmm. you got.
Well, I worked directly for the president. I didn't have to work through two vice presidents and three associate deans, that sort of thing, to get my message. And when I worked for Hannah, I knew what his schedule was. Hannah was an early morning person. I'm an early morning person. Darn poor finisher, but a good starter. And I would often meet him on the steps of the ad building as he was going to work when I had something to say to him. I also took the opportunity because of my position that when he will ask for transportation from point A to point B, often to the airport, I was the driver. And I had my boss locked in the front seat of the car and I had his ear, you know, this sort of thing.
Couldn't get away.
He couldn't get away. And that was the type of relationship that we had. He said things to me in private, and I said to him things to him in private. And as far as I know, I know I never divulged his private, and I don't think he did mine either.
What about?
I used to go up on a Saturday mornings, for example. I would meet him out at his chicken farm, and he was in his overalls and doing his chores, and I would drive up and have a few words with him and take off again. But a fine human being.
What about the other presidents you worked for? What sort of memories do you have of them? You worked with Hardin, of course, and following Wharton. And then,
well, let's say this. I have great respect for all but one. And he'll be nameless. The reasons for that negative is that I didn't trust.
And that's something you need in the position you're in.
That's right. Do you ever feel you're being used?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now we'll not get personal with regard to this at all. Mackey and DiBiagio I worked closely with both of them, got along fine. And we'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, we're at a point where we can change the tape, so just hold on a second.
We got that full of stuff already?
Oh, yeah, we're doing just fine.
Okay. I didn't know that this was a